ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this session, which is essentially about growth. Where is it going to go? Is it going to be the sort of town and country planning notion of new towns and new villages in the history of the garden cities? Is it going to be yet more intensification of inner London? Or, as I think the thrust of this session is about, can it, might it, and should it take place in the outer London boroughs, the more than 30 significant places, many of which have populations greater than significant towns outside London, but somehow sometimes get treated as though they're not exactly poor relations, but kind of a minor branch of the important real family, which is the cities of London and Westminster. We've got a very mixed panel. Let me introduce them very briefly. On my immediate left, Niraj Dixit, who is head of planning, senior director of planning at CBRE, and thanks to them for sponsoring this particular session. Then Ben Derbyshire, chairman of HTA Design, and like many architects specialising in housing, active at the moment in auditing and checking everything that they're doing on high rises in the past and currently. But more significantly, Ben has been proselytising for the densification of housing in the suburbs for quite a long period, and he's president-elect of the RIBA, so maybe talking to ministers about it in the near future. Next is Charlie Adden, who's chief executive of the Royal Borough of Kingston, a wonderful market town. I mean, in a sense, it's kind of almost what we can say again. Surrey within London, yeah, a kind of wonderful medieval vibe, but a subject of some intense development at the moment. Then we have Martin Scholar, who's head of planning at Barratt London and therefore one of the capital's most significant house builders, working pretty much at every scale other than one-off houses in most parts of the capital. And finally, but by no means least, Tony Brown, who's Chief Investment Officer at M&G Real Estate, who just announced a big new fund for investing in regional cities, but they've got an awful lot of money, so I'm sure there will be enough to go round. To kick us off, Niraj is going to give us a talk for 8 minutes or so. We will then take brief contributions from each of the other speakers. And I think once everybody's had their say, I'm going to go straight into questions and comments from the audience, and we'll try and run it as on familiar sort of question time type lines. So to kick us off, please welcome Niraj. Get this right. Niraj Dixit.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Paul. Good afternoon, everyone. I could talk to you for a very, very long time about how to accommodate London's growth. But first of all, Paul won't let me, and I'm only limited to up to 8 minutes. So I'm just going to focus on the key issues. First of all, let's get some context. London's a world city, a preeminent global business and financial location. And this status, despite some very, very sad and tragic events recently, is likely to continue for the foreseeable future. It does face its challenges. One of the most challenging is that London's population is increasing markedly, although the recent events with Brexit and the outcome of the general election and how that might influence that is uncertain at the moment. The population is forecast to grow from 8.2 million in 2011 to 10.11 million in 2036. Just to try and visualise that, that's almost the size of the city of Birmingham plus a small northern town. Just to visualise how to accommodate that is quite interesting. The composition of the population is also changing. There's an increasing proportion of younger people and at the same time an increasing proportion of elderly people. And some may say that that produces competition for limited resources. Now, there's a significant challenge of how best to manage and to accommodate this growth in London. My view, although in the audience and amongst the panel there may be an alternative view, is that we must plan for this growth. because to do otherwise would mean that London would be unprepared for this growth, and that would lead to unacceptable and adverse consequences. I'm now just going to focus on what I consider to be the key planning issues. In my view, the key to accommodating London's growth is to provide it in a sustainable way. And it's not just for housing, it's for employment, it's for social and community facilities, it's for public transport infrastructure, it's for public realm and open space, and also generally to improve the quality of the environment. In terms of housing, there's a real challenge. We need to provide in London 49,000 new units per year, and that's across all sectors, not just private units for sale, but build to rent and low cost affordable. But in the last 30 years, we've actually only achieved completions within a year of over 20,000 on five occasions. So the challenge, including to Alok Sharma, the new planning and housing minister, is quite clear. How we do that is challenging, but I think that we should take advantage of London's unique characteristics. Its vibrancy, its dynamism, its diversity, and at the same time, embracing and enhancing its identity, its neighbourhoods, and also its heritage. There's a hierarchy of planning policy that seeks to guide and nurture development in the country as well as London. At the national level, there's national planning policy, which is embodied in the national planning policy framework. That says a lot, but in summary, the headline is that there's a presumption in favour of sustainable development, which in my long career I think is very, very positive and supportive. Then there's the London Plan, which is the spatial development strategy for London, which I'll touch upon later on in my presentation. And then local plans prepared by individual authorities. Where should we densify? As land is a finite resource, I think that the onus is on us to make full and effective use of previously developed land. A clear way of doing this is to increase density of development generally. But in areas that have the ability to accommodate that development and associated with public transport, infrastructure, and utility expansion if necessary. Where are these areas? Well, the list isn't exhaustive, but it includes opportunity areas. The London Plan identifies 38 of those spread broadly across London with a variety of characteristics, and they're identified with having the ability to accommodate significant amounts of growth and development. And they vary in character from, say, the Upper Lee Valley in East London to Tottenham Court Road. At a slightly smaller level, the London Plan identifies seven areas for intensification. Now, they're also areas that are capable of intensification of development at higher densities, but not to the same degree as the opportunity areas. Town centres. The London Plan identifies 1,000 town centres across London. They clearly, in my view, have the potential to accommodate more development because they're accessible, they have a range of mix of land uses, and have good public transport connectivity. The outer London and suburbs comprise 80% of London's land and 60% of the population. Therefore, in my view, there's clear scope there for them to contribute towards help accommodating London's growth. But I'm not advocating that a sort of one-size-fits-all concept. It's all down to the individual characteristics of those areas. And then looking beyond London, but helping accommodate London's growth, is connections between other growth areas and transport corridors. For example, London to Luton to Bedford, London to Stansted to Cambridge, and perhaps even further on to Peterborough, and then the Wandle Valley from South London to Gatwick, and then also the Thames Gateway out to Southend, also West London towards the Thames Valley. Where should we densify? Well, in my view, not necessarily on this slide, but broader afield, I think we should utilise a range of methods. Transport improvements. It's been demonstrated over time that they are very, very important in helping facilitate and trigger growth and an improvement in the environment. There's the example of the Jubilee Line extension and how that's opened up tracts of land in East London. Hopefully, there'll be the same with the Northern Line extension, and the potential for Crossrail is evident, I think, to everyone. London's housing estate renewal. For instance, comprehensive redevelopment of existing council housing estates, like at Elephant and Castle, Thamesmead, and the Peabody housing estates, but also small infill developments which have the benefit of being less disruptive to local communities. Many of the estates, but not all of them, are in single ownership. They're accessible. They were built at the time at relatively low densities, and bearing in mind their age, they're probably due for renewal. Industrial relocation. Now, employment jobs are very, very important to London's economy, but in my view, there is scope to be able to relocate and consolidate those employment uses, particularly heavy industrial uses, from, say, Newham's Riverside to locations further east. As well as utilising private sector land and land owned by quangos, utilising in a more effective way surplus public sector land, such as NHS, estates, government property unit, local authorities land, GLA, TfL. Tall buildings. I know because of the very sad and tragic events in the news recently, it's a very emotive subject, and my hearts go out to everyone affected there. But I feel that they have a place to making a contribution, but they're not appropriate in all areas. How tall buildings meet the ground is very, very important as well. High quality design and how the building meets the ground in terms of vibrant and dynamic ground floor uses, good quality public realm and open space, and also opening up permeability and connectivity to the wider areas. Placemaking is also critical. It's not just the buildings, it's a sense of place and wanting to attract people and for them to spend time and dwell there. Finally, greenbelt, probably even more emotive than tall buildings. They're one of the longest enduring planning policy reforms in the system, but they do comprise 22% of London's area. My view is that greenbelts do merit a review, particularly their function, but I don't think they should be the starting point for accommodating London's needed growth. It's just that they should be part of that wider strategy. Thank you.
Niraj, thank you for that. I think you set the scene admirably. Ben Derbyshire.
Thank you very much, Niraj. So I'm going to talk about additionality to that because I completely agree with much of what Niraj has said. And I think the difficulty we find is that even with all of that, we still fall short in terms of the SHLA, the Strategic Housing Land Assessment. So we at HTA with Savills and the firm called Apex Developments have been looking at ways in which we can exploit that part of the outer boroughs that Niraj did not talk about, the difficult bit, the huge patchwork of suburban land which is in private ownership, mostly semi-detached houses. So we've done a piece of work which we're submitting to the GLA as our contribution to the consultation on a city for all Londoners. We've found 170 stations in London with less than half an hour to travel to significant employment, which is surrounded with development at less than 20 dwellings per hectare. So our speculation is, okay, let's take 10 hectares around all of that lot, and let's postulate that you could do a master plan with a design code, nothing above six stories, that transforms that 10 hectares into 100 habitable homes per hectare. Not a big deal, not difficult. Every one of those, that would yield 2,000 homes. Then if you were to take a larger catchment area within the footfall, the 1 kilometre footfall around those stations, and if you were to deploy a slightly less intensive regime, we estimate yield through our Superbia project an increase in density from 20 to 40 homes per hectare. That gives you a further 2,000 additional homes, and all of this, you know, in a carefully designed way, in using techniques to make sure that no neighbour impinges unnecessarily, unfairly on anybody else, and all of it on the premise that the owners, the private owners of those plots, stand to benefit. So working with Savills, the proposition is in those 10-hectare zones around the stations, individual homeowners of a typical 8x40 suburban plot would be able to yield £200,000 per plot with current values, and in the slightly larger zone, a further £100,000 a plot. So the whole proposition is about turning NIMBYs to YIMBYs to enable a process of gradual and natural development, which, after all, in London happens all the time. Look at Notting Hill. Look at South Shoreditch. Look how, in a generation, places which were once laid waste have been completely transformed. So our Superbia idea is really about taking those kinds of places, providing people with the sorts of incentives that took place naturally in Notting Hill and in South Shoreditch, and creating a framework that will enable them to yield development value and solve not only London's housing problem as a whole, but some of the neighbourhood problems about well-being, about under-occupation, and about overwhelming space with the motor car. So the proposition is about a win-win solution which makes better places for local people, more homes adjacent to existing infrastructure, which is sorely wasted at the moment, and the estimate over a generation of that kind of activity is a million additional new homes over one generation. All we have to do is create the policies, build a process, and get political support for it.
Ben, thank you very much for that clarion call for density and numbers. A simple matter of politics and delivery. Charlie Adden.
That's thrown me a challenge. So I want to give the perspective from an outer London borough chief executive who isn't a property or a planning person, and from a borough which is full of opportunities and where we're looking for good growth. Just a few facts about the Royal Borough. Kingston itself is the former county town of Surrey, but it has and it is and has been for many years part of London. It's the oldest royal borough, the home of Saxon kings, with a rich, impressive heritage in a riverside location. It's part of the South London Partnership, picking up your theme, Paul, 28 billion economy, bigger than Leeds, Birmingham or Manchester in South London, the five boroughs in South London. We expect a 15 to 20% increase in population over 25 years. That's 25 to 40,000 people. So at the top end, that's bigger than any of the market towns I was dealing with in Suffolk in my former role. Always challenges around Greenbelt and metropolitan open land, but our policy is clear on that, and that's to protect it. Always challenges around affordability. Growing density, yes. But a desire for exemplary design. We've got a thriving economy, good mix, strong sectoral representation, and a population better qualified than most of the UK and indeed London. So we're preparing for a step change in growth. We've prepared a direction of travel as one of London's opportunity areas with the GLA, and we've got a new local plan issues and options process underway. So we're aiming for consistency with both London and national planning policy. And my proposition as a London chief exec is that if we're going to do some of the exciting things that we've heard about, we need to change our relationship as a local authority with our communities and with all of those people, including people in this room, who have a stake in our future, and put communities at the heart of shaping the growth which will inevitably need to be accommodated. So firstly, we need to change our approach. Our role as a local authority should be different. We should be creating a different type of relationship with our communities, not informing, not consulting, not listening, but actually convening, facilitating, and enabling communities to get really involved in shaping growth. That requires a different type of community and system leadership, one that helps others see the bigger picture rather than just pursuing their own personal focus. It requires us to encourage reflection and generative discussions that build relationships, not undermine them. And it requires us to focus people on finding solutions to shared challenges. And for me, that means developing a workforce right across the council, not just in our planning and property teams, that contain these facilitating, enabling, and leadership skills at every level. It will not be possible for us to get everybody on board with everything, but I think if people feel more in control and more able to influence the things which will change where they live and how they live, then we may succeed in meeting the challenge. Secondly, we need to share the challenges. Ben's account is really interesting. I didn't know those facts. I now know those facts. It will change my thinking about this. And I question whether we ever really share enough of the facts with our communities and combine that with their lived experience to understand how places could and should grow. So I think it's that common shared understanding that will bring people together and help us resolve conflicting views and create great places of the future. Finally, we need to engage people differently. Recent events last week illustrate the danger of not listening or hearing everyone's voice, I would suggest. We need to find ways of making it easier for people to influence decisions. If we don't, the more timid will not speak out in public meetings. The fighters will be disproportionately listened to. The settled population's influence will make those who are less settled or new to a place more marginalised. And the time poor, all those people who get on the train in Surbiton in Kingston and go to London every day, will struggle to engage. And we need to adopt new ways of engaging. We've got a recent experience in Kingston of a developer who's engaged the community in designing a development, and they've turned what was a vocal opposition into a very supportive community, and I think we ought to learn from that. So in short, my colleagues and I, councillors and officers, political and professional and technical, have embraced the need for this change, and we're on our journey. We're intent on changing our relationship with all those with a stake in Kingston Futures. And being an enabling council, I'd encourage you to come to Kingston, find out about our opportunities and join us in bringing about that change. Thank you.
Charlie, thank you very much. Now on to someone who actually has to deliver homes for a living, Martin Scholar.
Thanks, Paul. Happily, I saw Niraj's slide this morning, and we're developing in all those areas he identified. So we're in the opportunity areas, intensification areas. We're actually in the Green Belt, which is another story. We're looking at old industrial land, and we're in the inner urban areas as well as the suburbs. So we're developing around 2,000 units a year. I did some homework last night. There's 20 of those sites are in zones 1 and 2, and another 20 are in zones 3 to 6. So we're across London. And as I said, we're in the inner urban areas. We've got developments in Aldgate, Nine Elms and Blackfriars Road. We're in town centres, we're at Wembley, Camden and Hounslow. And yes, the outer suburbs as well, the inner suburbs, places like Catford, Upton Park, West Ham's former ground. And then we've recently bought some very significant amounts of land in Harrow, is about 1,000 units. And Hayes is another 1,400 units, a joint venture with Segrow. So we're across London, but what we find, because we research and go back to ask our residents after what they like and don't like about our developments, and it's always the same thing. It's affordability, it's location, and it's the quality of the place. So we're sort of very conscious of those factors when we look at new developments. And it's very interesting that certain things that people say are very important to one group aren't so important to the others. So, for example, schools continually comes up on our sites in the suburbs, but we have downsizers in places like Barnet. The schools aren't an issue for them. So more important things are things like train links, the shops and the restaurants, the green spaces, health facilities, and parking as well. Parking's a very emotive issue, and we're finding it very different approach across London right now. So Camden and Ealing, two developments we're taking through planning at the moment, it's car-free, no cars at all. Whereas in Hillingdon, we've had a very interesting discussion over the last year about the parking numbers on a site right next to Hayes and Harlington Station, which will be a Crossrail station. So we started from a position of having low parking, but we've gradually gone up. So we're very interested in all those issues. And I was particularly interested in the Gordon Ingram's research, London First research, that came out last week, where they're talking about an amenity index. instead of a density index that's in the London plan at the moment. And we think that's a far more, well, I think it's a far more sophisticated way of looking at the quality of place and what makes places attractive. I think my final point is about the suburbs, and in particular, there's two things that are going to happen, and Neeraj mentioned them, is Crossrail or the Elizabeth Line, and it really is transformational. So our site next to Hayes and Harlington Station currently take you 53 minutes to get to Liverpool Street. From next year, that'll be 27 minutes. Canary Wharf goes from 56 minutes down to 34. So places that currently Zone 5 will have a very different proposition in terms of transport links. And on the east side of London, Ilford to Farringdon, which I googled this morning, that goes from 34 minutes down to 17. So it's really that is coming really quickly now. I think the final thing is the overlooking distances. So in Camden, they between windows, it's 18 metres, and in Hillingdon, it's 21 metres. So I think we need a far more sophisticated discussion about the way we densify. I think a really interesting example is the one next to City Hall by Barclay, one of our rivals. And the overlooking distances there must be about 9 or 10 metres. So if you're the planning consultant, I need to speak to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm sure there'll be a queue afterwards. And finally, Tony Brown.
Yeah, thank you, Paul. Good afternoon, everybody. Just by way of background, M&G Real Estate are one of the largest international real estate fund managers. So we invest in about 20 countries globally. So the question is, why are we interested in suburban London, given the choice we have of where we invest our clients' capital? And the answer is housing, and in particular, the private rented sector. Now, this is a sector that in the past has been pretty much dominated by private individuals who've bought maybe one or two flats for their pension or for their long-term savings. But in recent years, people like ourselves and some of our peer group have become much more interested in this. In this sector, primarily because of the strong supply and demand dynamics of the sector. Looks to be a good area of investment. Low interest rates are supporting investment in real estate generally, and the housing sector and PRS looks to be a good long-term investment proposition. Also, I think a lot of institutions are becoming more familiar with the sector as well. So going back about 10 years, student housing first begun being invested by institutional investors. So people like ourselves and others have become comfortable with investing in student housing, and the PRS sector is really a natural extension of that investment. Probably our hardest task, though, is not raising capital. So we've managed to raise about £700 million of capital in the last 4 years alone for the private rented sector in the UK. So that's pretty significant. That basically funds over 2,000 homes, and that's just ourselves, and our peers are doing something similar. But our hardest task really is finding sites, because the traditional model in the UK for house builders is to build it and sell it rather than build it to rent. But what we're now starting to see emerge is a build-to-rent sector from people like ourselves who are prepared to fund these developments, which are purely built for the rental sector for long-term income growth, to supply the needs of our clients who are pensioners and people who are saving money for their long-term welfare. So this is starting to emerge now as a more established sector, but it's still very nascent. So about less than 2% of institutional money within real estate is invested in the PRS sector in the UK. That compares to about a quarter of the market in the US. So you may have heard people talk about the multifamily investment sector in the United States. That takes about 25% of institutional money alongside things like offices and shopping centres. So in the UK, there's a huge amount of growth potentially to come in the future. I think Knight Frank actually produced a report last week that showed that current investment in the private rented sector for institutional investors is less than $20 billion at the moment, and that's expected to increase to about $75 billion over the next 10 years. So a huge amount of finance available for this type of development. And we've been particularly interested in London suburbs. So we've undertaken a plan of investing in places like North Acton, Ilford, which Martin just mentioned, in Poplar and East Ham and other London boroughs, where basically we can provide purpose-built rental accommodation which is affordable for working Londoners. So our target market is basically a 25 to 35-year-old person, maybe in their first or second job in London, probably working in central London. So most of our developments are close to public infrastructure, so either close to new Crossrail stations, which will come on stream next year, existing tube and rail lines. And by our calculation, the rental levels in some of these developments demand that the person needs to earn probably £30,000 a year to be able to afford the rent, either in a one-bed or, say, two-bedroom flat. Now, in the context of wages in London, and certainly for working people, we believe that's an affordable level of rent, given that level of income. So we're hoping it does partly answer some of the housing needs of the UK and in London in particular through the financing we have available. So there's a lot more to come, a lot more to do. Quality of design has been mentioned a couple of times already. It's really important. You know, there are an awful lot of permitted development, change of use from offices to residential, which are actually really poor quality, and we're quite concerned about that. But you need to get in early as a developer and deliver rented accommodation that's designed for renters rather than for the sale market, because there's a big difference between the two in terms of design. So we want to get in really early with developers and start influencing the design of some of these schemes.
Thank you very much indeed. Well, I think that in a sense the panel is wildly agreeing that the outer London boroughs are an appropriate place for growth. They've been identified by a sort of strategic planning consultant. Ben knows what to do, just intensify and densify around the stations, but with the cooperation of NIMBYs, who become YIMBYs. Charlie's dead set on the development in Kingston, but by implication right across those South London boroughs. Martin is doing it already, and Tony's ready to put money into, so question solved, job done. Let me throw a little spanner in the works. If it's so easy, why the hell have we only managed to do it more than 20,000 units on five occasions in the last 20 years? I mean, what is it? Why apparently has the mighty private house building sector failed to do all this stuff? Or maybe it's not a failure. Who'd like to pick this one up? Martin, I mean, why haven't we built more given this incessant demand, rising population, et cetera, et cetera?
It's a very good question. I think we're pretty much at full pelt. We're building 2,000 a year in London. And it's, I think nationally we get to about 17,000. I can't give you an answer why, because we would build more if we could. I think if we had more land, if we had the enough construction workers, then we would build more. But I think we're pretty much at full pelt at the moment.
Ben.
Well, Paul, Rome was not built in a day. I wrote my first speculation about build-to-rent in 2008, just after the crash, coining the phrase easy let. Little did I know that easy let was not to come for another 7 or 8 years, because you have to build a market, you have to create a whole investment class, you have to have people with expertise, and you have a planning system that doesn't recognise the building typology that it's necessary to use with shared circulation hotel style. So it's always a long and complicated task. We've been talking about superbia in my business at HCA for 8 years now, and finally the Outer London Commission report is peppered with references to it, and that really is just the beginning of the change of policy.
But what about this issue of land? I mean, from your point of view, is there a shortage of land or isn't there? Or what are the blockages to this land being put into use? Is it the planning system, despite the good intentions of the MPPF? On the ground, does it kind of work as it should do?
Well, Paul, you've raised a very valid point in terms of the National Planning Policy Framework, because when it was first published, it was the first time in my professional career that national government had issued planning guidance that effectively said the starting point to local authorities and other people involved in considering and determining applications, the initial response should be yes rather than no. And I think that's really positive and really constructive. In answer to the other question about do I personally think that there's an overall shortage in land, my view is in certain areas land is no doubt constrained. But that the onus is upon people in this room and this panel and others elsewhere to think about the use of that land more innovatively and more imaginatively. But in summary, my personal focus and interest is in East London, South London, North East London, where 20, 30 years ago, it was very difficult to persuade private sector to invest there. That's very, very different now. It's for a multitude of reasons, but part of that reason is transport accessibility. It's just so easy, as Martin has outlined, for people who are interested in buying or renting some of their properties to travel to and from. And also, they're creating a place. There's places where you can eat and shop and your children can go to school. In short, I don't think there's a shortage of land, but we need to think more imaginatively. Last year, I had the benefit of acting on behalf of the London Borough of Hackney, as an example. They have a pressing need to provide new schools, but they have no money to pay for it. So very bravely, the finance director at Hackney came out with an initiative to build new schools, but with tall residential development above the schools, to pay for the schools. And they did it. It wasn't easy. It was a real challenge. And of course, there's very right sensitivities about overlooking and privacy that you need to safeguard in the design. But that's just one small way.
And Charlie?
I think for me, as I said before, I'm not a property or planning professional. So it troubles me that we've been, for the last years since I've been in local government, trying to find the silver bullet that's going to solve this problem. It's a very attractive proposition for politicians to find a single answer to a multifaceted problem. It's very tempting as well if you're a professional or technical person. And I think the reason I was talking about communities involved in this is because that's where the solution lies. It's not a single thing. So it's not that people are sitting on land. It's about a whole multitude of things. For me, I think there are two things though. One is that I think maybe it's my age, but I think we are not doing enough to incentivise people to move at the right point in their life. It causes us huge problems in local government in terms of the adult social care and other things that flow from that, and we should do more about it. And I think we've been building the wrong things. Our obsession, which we've just heard about, with owner occupation has probably not done the job that we needed it to do. So I think we need to look at it as a complex problem because it's a complex problem. Yeah. And involve more people in helping us resolve it.
Right, I'm throwing it open now to the floor. Any questions for this mixed panel? Yeah, there's at the back. Yes, please. Tell us who you are.
It's William Jackson, Paul, Crossrail 2 Property and TFL Commercial Development. It's interesting here, the private sector sitting here saying, you know, we're doing all we can. And the biggest issue we have is that the private sector isn't actually meeting the demands of the people who want housing generally. What I've found in these last couple of days is everybody talks about infrastructure, yet nobody I've heard yet has talked about who pays for the infrastructure. Oh, sorry, I'm holding the microphone wrongly. So nobody's actually talked about who pays for the infrastructure, and obviously the private sector's extracting large amounts of value out of building adjacent to stations, and stations has been mentioned on Superbia by Charlie and I can't remember the two other names, but you know, if we're wanting to increase the densities around the city, we have to increase the infrastructure around the city. But nobody is addressing that problem. I mean, lots of talk about it, and I've heard it for years. Yeah, we need to spend more on it. But we have not seen the private sector come forward and say, actually, we'll pick up the cost of infrastructure. Does the panel have any view on this?
Well, I'm going to ask Tony Brown to comment on that because it's an institutional finance question in a way. Although, let me presage that by saying I sometimes wonder, when Crossrail levy came in, it's pretty remarkable that London managed to build an entire underground network. How did we do that? Anyway, I'll leave that question hanging in the air. But any comment on this question about who pays for infrastructure?
Yeah, I mean, it's an age-old problem, really, in the UK, particularly because of the, I guess, lack of infrastructure investment that we've had generally over the last, probably 40 or 50 years in our country, certainly compared to other countries around the world. You know, our infrastructure spending is probably less actually against GDP than most of our peers. I think the main issue, I mean, I'm not an infrastructure investor, so I'll just caveat what I say with that, but I think the main issue generally for financial backers of infrastructure generally is that generally speaking, the returns that you get from putting a lot of money to pay for a train line or whatever it might be comes later on. The initial costs are huge, so the benefits tend to come years later. I mean, Crossrail has been, when I first started working in London in the early 90s, Crossrail was being talked about then. And we're now 20 years later, or 30 years later. So for anybody to put money up front for those types of projects, it's quite difficult. Because at the end of the day, when you talk about private finance, we're basically representing people's pensions and savings. So those people who are saving money for their pensions or for savings need to receive a return on their investment. That needs to be a return that needs to be fairly certain against the risk, but also it can't be over too long a period, because otherwise those people aren't going to get the money they're expecting from people like ourselves who are representing them. So I do think that in some of the really big scale projects, which are really long term, it really has to be the public purse that leads the way. Now, there is ways of financing things through the private sector. We used to have PFI in the UK, which hasn't existed now for a number of years. The coalition government basically removed that because of a number of issues of PFI. But PFI did actually finance a large rebuilding of our schools and hospitals in the UK from the mid-90s to the to the middle of the 2000s. So there have been techniques and ways of doing it, but there's never really been, since PFI was pretty much abolished a few years ago, not really any mechanisms that exist for private institutions to invest in some of these larger scale projects. But it's not an easy answer. I mean, we have to do the best we can for people's pensions and savings, and that has to meet the demands of providing infrastructure. And somehow you've got to put the two crossroads together to get an acceptable return for acceptable risk. It certainly isn't easy.
Ben, quick one?
Just a thought. Turning your question on its head, if I may. So one of the propositions about the Superbia idea is about sweating existing infrastructure. So the way in which these railways in the 19th century were built is they were built avoiding the town centres so that they could just travel through agricultural land. And then the agricultural land was transformed into suburban land at between 15 and 20 homes per hectare. So the proposition is actually about sweating the existing infrastructure harder and using this concept of Yolanda Barnes at Savile of place potential. So it's a bit like electricity. Differential potential gives you the voltage to create change and the opportunity for each homeowner of a small plot to gain very substantial equity in their domestic finances through a development regime, which admittedly doesn't exist yet because the policy doesn't exist yet. But the idea is to create the opportunity for urban intensification, indeed urbanization around these stations, not unduly dense and certainly not high-rise, which would, over the huge swathe of outer London, as you've heard, create a very considerable contribution to resolving the problem.
Let's take another question. Yes, please, at the back.
Hello. Hello, Conor McDonough from Lambeth Council. I just wanted to pick up on that last point that Ben made. I'll probably challenge that, because if you speak to any from TfL or use TfL, you realise the infrastructure is already at severe capacity. So I think sweating the existing infrastructure for those suburban rail stations might be problematic. I'm just wondering how you'd like to come back on that, or whether your research has done some capacity analysis of those stations.
Yes. Sorry.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very happy to do that. Yes, clearly, the existing infrastructure needs investment too. In systems, in trains that run closer to each other, in longer trains and longer platforms, all of that completely agree. So it's not as if it doesn't need any investment. But of course, it's not as expensive as building a new railway, as we can see from the vast sums of money and also the political problems of doing something apparently simple like connecting King's Cross to Euston for HS2. So, my view is, yes, of course you need that investment, but it's simpler and less expensive. And, of course, there is the other issue, which is the transformation which we anticipate in the other aspect of infrastructure are roads and the motor cars that dominate them, and the whole question of autonomous vehicles and so on, and the impact that that is inevitably going to have, yet being researched, on access to places of employment.
I'm going to ask a final question before we head for lunch. I'd like to get a response from all the panelists, which is a sort of political question, really, because clearly a big advanced economy like ours with huge construction capacity that can do anything from home extensions to the Channel Tunnel, for some reason, has not delivered necessary housing, really, in London for a very long time. Is it your view that the likelihood of us succeeding this task can only happen if we have a fairly fundamental change of political attitude where the public sector not only takes responsibility but gets more controls? In other words, the mayor suddenly starts exercising his CPO powers, exploits public land, which exists, the old LDA land and the Legacy Development Corporation land, to create the sufficient numbers, rather like the Olympic Delivery Authority created a very, very big development, basically by being in charge. Is that actually what we need to get things done? Let's run along the line. Start with you, Tony.
Well, yeah, I think as we've said before, it's multidimensional. So, you know, is housing taken seriously by the government? You know, we've had more housing ministers, I think, over the last 10 years than Chelsea have had football managers. You know, we've got a new housing, you know, paper that's come out. There's some good things in that, which we are quite supportive of, particularly around build to rent. But is it really going far enough? I mean, ultimately, it needs everybody, including ourselves as financiers, to, you know, to get behind this. I mean, there's clearly an urgent need. Everyone recognises the need. But it's not only London. I mean, this is a problem faced in most of the major capitals around the world. So I think we can also learn from what we see overseas. You know, you go to something like Tokyo, for example, and the actual density there compared to London is much more intense. People live in much smaller units of accommodation than they do in the UK. So socially, are we prepared to accept that? Are we prepared to accept that we live in smaller accommodation than we've done in the past? So these are kind of social as well as political and economic issues that need to be addressed. But no one's saying it's easy because it's not.
Thank you.
I think for
Martin.
I think private house builders are only part of the solution. I think from the top of my head, the only time we've ever actually reached the government figures was just after the Second World War, when there was a massive funding of council housing. And I think that's the only way we would ever get back to those figures. Other than that, we'll sit here year after year saying we're not going to hit those figures.
Charlie?
So I find myself in difficult territory as a politically neutral officer. But what I would say, what last week taught us, is that in order for politicians to do anything, they have to get elected. And in order to get elected, they have to be popular. And that creates a huge tension. What I would say is that I've worked for some great politicians and I've worked for some not so great politicians. And I'll go back to my issue of community leadership. The best politicians I've worked for are the ones who don't think they've got all the answers. They recognise that creating those answers requires an engagement with communities, big, small, macro or micro, and that they have a role to play in terms of facilitating the right type of conversations. And I think, you know, we've had, I worked for two of them, for Ken and then Boris for a short time. I haven't had the privilege of working for Sadiq, but I think London's been pretty well served by its mayors looking from outside from a neutral point of view, and I've not been in London long enough to pass judgment on the political leadership more broadly, but it certainly requires political leadership, but perhaps political leadership of a different type.
Thank you.
Order.
Ben?
Well, I can make that challenge from where I sit, and I ask the question, how could it possibly be that we've come to a place where delivering a public good, which I'm all sure is what we're talking about here, creating good neighbourhoods for our children to live affordably in, how come that has got to be a problem for politicians? Because, you know, if they postulate that answer, they don't get votes. How can that be? So that's why we're putting forward the idea of a housing expo. What we want at the RIBA and at New London Architecture and at the Design Museum is for politicians to back them putting their money where their mouth is and show the world what great placemaking actually is like. This is what they do in Northern Europe. Every time there's a major regeneration project, there's always a Bauausstellung to go along with it, which is basically the public-facing expression of why doing what they're doing is a good thing and a way of engaging their stakeholders in that process. So that's what we would like to see in London and actually all over the UK in order that politicians can say That's what good looks like, and go and see it and be in it, because that's what it feels like to be in something that's a good place to be.
Thank you. Niraj.
Thank you for the applause. Thank you, Paul. I agree with everything that the panel has actually said. The scenario that you outlined, I think, is a very important and a key ingredient in us helping meet the need to accommodate this growth. It's not the sole solution, but the aspect that I think is particularly relevant from my personal experience is what Ben and Charlie have actually mentioned, in that, and perhaps we haven't done it very well as a development industry as a whole, and that's marketing and selling development, which is generally positive. Often, development is seen as negative, whether it's financial or whether it's the softer community benefits. The onus is upon all of the industry to sell that development a little better so that everyone has buy-in.
Thank you. Concluding remark, Nick Rainsford, former housing minister, told me a while back that the last year in which we built sufficient housing for anticipated national need was 1978. And at that time, there were four sources of housing: the private sector, then as now, housing associations, then as now, council housing, more or less wiped out now, and new towns. We haven't got any. So we reduced the number of suppliers, and with the exception of the PRS sector, which is starting to come in a bit, I think that's the simple explanation why we haven't built enough. We haven't had enough people doing it, especially from the public sector side. So my answer, real answer to William Jackson's question about infrastructure is, well, why don't we be more like what the people in Hong Kong, who combined infrastructure with housing development? How did they do that? They did it by owning the land and, in best Victorian traditions, exploiting the value created by the new infrastructure. And the reason that's a political decision is what politicians are going to say: I'm going to CPO all the land I need for this infrastructure and all the land around it, and I'm going to pay for the one via the other. Does that get votes? I'll leave that question hanging in the air. Enjoy your lunch and panel. Thank you very much indeed.